The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The fact is that we're able to get some out, and the idea that we would now put them in jeopardy and potentially one day even deport them is important to me. And if it was to come to pass, I don't know how any ally in the future could ever look to us and trust us and take us at our word when we said that we're going to have their back if needed. So the current status is this. There is a bipartisan group of senators and House representatives, Republicans and Democrats on both sides, that want to vote on this thing. And if it came up for a fair vote, I think it would pass.
I'm Bryce Clem, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 15th, 2022. On Monday, the Brookings Institution hosted a panel discussion titled Allies, How America Failed Its Partners in Afghanistan. The event featured a preview clip of Episode 6 of Allies, which is out now, followed by a discussion with an all-star panel. The panel included Shala Ghaffari, the managing attorney for Project Afghan Legal Assistance at Human Rights First, Colonel Steve Miska, who serves on the steering committee of the Evacuate Our Allies Coalition, and Matt Zeller, a U.S. Army veteran and co-founder of No One Left Behind and an advisory board chair of the Association of Wartime Allies. We discuss some of the past failures that led to a situation where tens of thousands of the U.S.'s allies were left behind in Afghanistan. We also discuss current resettlement issues and relocation efforts for those still in Afghanistan or other third countries. In this episode, we've presented the event's audio to you. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Wednesday, June 15th, Allies, How America Failed Its Partners in Afghanistan.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies here at Brookings and the Editor-in-Chief of Lawfare. We're here at Brookings, at a Brookings event, talking about issues covered in Allies, which is a new podcast series from Lawfare and our partners at Goat Rodeo. This morning, we released the sixth episode of the series, which covers the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in the summer of 2021 and tells the story of the events at the Kabul airport last August. In many ways, the events of last August were a kind of culmination of the problems that had existed with the SIV program for two decades. And those are problems we are still feeling the effects of today. So the clip that you're about to hear is from episode six, and in it you will hear from an Afghan interpreter whom we call Billy, who had applied for a special immigrant visa.
In the last days of the evacuation, Billy, the Afghan interpreter, was still waiting on his SIV application. At one point, Billy thought about just making a go of it and heading to the airport.
I was in touch with some friends who even got the airport passage email from the Department of State. And they went to the airport, and I was following them to see what it was like.
But on TV and social media, Billy saw the massive crowds, the Taliban beatings, the explosion at Abbey Gate. And he still hadn't heard back from the embassy about his visa. So he stayed home and waited for an official green light.
And I was sure that they won't let anyone without the gate passage until I found out that it was a total miss. And those who pushed and wrestled further in the crowd even without SIV cases or SIV documents, made it through and were evacuated. And by then, it was too late for me.
Billy watched as thousands of Afghans like him packed into flights. But he had done what the U.S. government had told him to do. He followed the rules. So, Billy waited and watched as he got left behind. To this day, he still hasn't gotten any updates on his visa. Billy and his family are in Afghanistan right now, still waiting. He has no idea what the status of his application is, and if it's even being processed. But he remembers August 30th vividly. That was the day the last American flight left the Kabul airport.
You know, I never cry. But that moment, you know, my eyes were just tearing. You know, I'm a father of two sweet kids. And I would look at them and I don't know what will happen. Because after that, when the final flight left, you know, things were like, I don't know how to explain it to you, but it was bad. It was bad. But I'm happy that I'm still alive.
So this project was the first major podcast project that I've ever really been able to step back from and not play a significant role in. And that's owing to two things. One is the remarkable group of partners we have at Goat Rodeo, and on this project, particularly Max Johnston. The other is Bryce, our associate editor, who conceptualized this project and really operated as our end of the partnership in producing it. So all thanks to all of you, and Bryce in particular. And with that, I'm going to turn things over to Bryce.
Thank you, Ben, and welcome everyone. As Ben said, we'll be discussing some of the past failures that led to a situation where tens of thousands of people like Billy, who had served with the United States, were left behind. As Ben said, we'll also discuss some current resettlement issues and relocation efforts for those still in Afghanistan and other third countries. So that clip that we just heard, as Ben said, is featured in the sixth episode of the series. And a lot of what we witnessed last August had its roots in a struggle that has lasted for more than a decade. So to get us started, I want to ask Colonel Miska to help give us the long view. Colonel Miska, you've been involved in this issue for a very long time, since 2006, really. So what were some of the issues that you had been dealing with since 2006 that really set the stage for the events that we all witnessed last year?
Thanks, Bryce. This is a strategic problem that does not just span current conflict. And some of the research I've done goes way back. And as a matter of fact, some of the best practices that we shared come from, say, Vietnam, or when we evacuated the Kurds or the Kosovars more recently. And so as I started really digging into the problem, it was clear that we didn't have a lot of policy tools to insulate our soft networks, our closest partners in conflict zones. But we did have the special immigrant visa, and it is a bureaucratic challenge, as many have noted. So our government has struggled to really execute well, even though we do have this one tool. And so really, when it becomes a crisis, our immigration system writ large is not suited to it doesn't work, function well normally, right? So it doesn't, in a crisis, it's not the tool to go to. So some of the things that I delved into were interagency task forces that we used in Vietnam, which allowed somebody with presidential authority to manage an intergovernmental effort, really a whole of society effort when it comes down to it. And you can flex that authority where it's needed. So say Afghanistan or Vietnam under a foreign service officer, and then bring it here to the United States when the center of gravity shifts, when you've got the refugees in. Those are things that history teaches us, and hopefully we can learn from in the future.
So Matt and Shala, before we get into current issues, which we definitely will, I want to ask if you have anything in mind about failures, either political, bureaucratic, or structural in the past decade that really led to the situation that we're facing to now. And Shala, let's start with you.
Great. Thank you so much, Bryce. And thank you to Brookings and Lawfare for bringing attention to this really important issue. I would actually bring us back to the year 2020. Under President Trump, the fact that the Doha peace agreement with the Taliban was signed without any Afghan government presence. And I really want to highlight that. It was a peace agreement between the U.S. government to withdraw their troops and between the Taliban. And the only condition really was that the Taliban were to not allow Al-Qaeda to operate within its territories. There was no plan about how the transition would actually work. There was no promise for a democracy or a semblance of democracy to continue. No Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the war crimes committed by the Taliban for the past, at that point, nearly 20 years, actually beyond, because the Taliban, of course, had ruled that country for most of the country for a good part of the 90s. And there was no commitment by the Taliban to ensure the rights of women, girls, and ethnic minorities, religious minorities. So I would really bring us back to that date and for us to really contemplate as to how much of all of this is really a surprise, considering the terms in which this peace agreement was signed.
Great. And Matt?
I mean, everything Shala said is spot on. I think the only thing I would add to that is in the Doha deal, there was a particular provision that required us to pull all of our contractor support to the Afghan military. And this harkens back to a decision that was made, you know, almost 20 years ago at this point, which was, what would the Afghan military look like? How were we going to train and build a force that was ostensibly supposed to be able to replace us and outlast us? And we decided to build a modern, technologically dependent military, a military in our own image, a military that, quite frankly, could not function without those contractors, which is why the Taliban insisted that those contractors be removed. And all you have to see is the degree to which the country began to collapse as soon as they were gone. I've talked to many members of the Afghan military who would tell me that they'd be, you know, as of July and August last year, they would be in the middle of battles, and all of a sudden their air support was just gone. Their radios suddenly didn't work anymore. And it was because the contractors that we had paid to support them and make sure that their military functioned were no longer there. And I think that's a big learning lesson for our country going forward. If we ever going to find ourselves in a similar conflict, a force that we're building needs to be able to sustain itself without our own, you know, constant, basically, lifeline.
So last August, and really since then, all of you have been working on some different aspects of resettlement and relocation efforts. And Colonel Miska, I want to start with you. You've been working with the Evacuate Our Allies Coalition, as I mentioned earlier. So tell us about that work and really how the group was created and some of the challenges that you've faced since then.
Sure. The coalition started very quickly after the announcement to withdraw in April. And the steering committee began meeting on a routine basis, but then as we saw things getting urgent, because most of the work was advocacy to try to offer best practices to the Biden administration to get ahead of what we knew was going to happen to our allies. As we saw things start to unravel, that coalition started meeting twice a day. Another coalition stood up, started meeting twice a day, and I ended up going to LA and standing up an operations center that was running 24/7 to support both of those coalitions, because the distress calls that were coming in were just so unrelenting, and it was really, really rough. That work continues, Bryce. It has not stopped. We're still 7 days a week. And I mean, just last month, we had over 860 requests come in to the ops center. We're working on getting people out, and we get them through all the partners in the ecosystem, but that's what they do, are the partners who we support. We basically connect, we're business to business enterprise, right? We connect the different partners in the ecosystem so they can collaborate well. And I would point out that, you know, Shala's organization is what I would call the anchor species in that ecosystem, or one of the main organizations, you know, leading the charge from the Evacuator Allies. And then all the work that the different teams do has just kept the attention on in a way that at least we're getting some people out. It's hard, it's difficult, but we keep at it every day. And I'll just leave it there.
Well, give us, you know, you don't have to use any specifics, but maybe give us some examples of what you're facing to some audience members who might not know what it's like.
Sure. So because we cover the entire ecosystem, we could get calls that come from Afghanistan. Routinely, we get calls from an American who is advocating on behalf of Afghans who are still trapped, and they might be in harm's way, or they might just need food and some sort of shelter. And so we work with different partners that way. We also get calls from people stuck in third countries. And if need be, we work with different partners in the coalition to advocate either through the State Department or different consulates in order to see if we can get safe passage for them. And then lastly, here in the United States, we will get calls for people who have been paroled in, which affords no legal status. So they don't qualify for any benefits. And they are relying on just the goodwill of whoever they happen to have come into contact here in the United States and are having a hard time transitioning or might not be able to get a case with a resettlement agency. And so we try to find the organizations that might have capacity to help those cases and then make the referrals.
So Matt, I want to move to you. The Association of Wartime Allies released, I think, its second report from this year that has some updated numbers on the amount of applicants, SIV applicants specifically, in the pipeline, and also some feedback from those still in Afghanistan. I was wondering if you could sort of walk us through some of the findings of that report.
Sure. So this is going to be something that the Association of Wartime Allies will be doing quarterly going forward. The report is quite illuminating. So AWA has a unique ability to survey the left behind Afghan population. They run a private Facebook group that has been curated over 3-4 years now that has some 30,000 Afghans in it. They've all been vetted. They've had to prove that they've applied for the special immigration visa program, et cetera. And through that survey, what they've learned is that, you know, Afghanistan has really become hell on earth for women. It's you know, everything that we warned that this was the same evil Taliban, just better equipped, has come to fruition. They're right back to where they were, you know, in July of 2001 and in August in 2001, before September 11th. Women have no place in Afghan society outside of the home, fundamentally and functionally do not have any rights, and are living under a type of oppression that is just, as a father of a daughter, it sickens me. I mean, you read statistics like a third of all women surveyed had reported that they had been sexually molested by the Taliban since being taken over, propositioned in a way that they didn't want to be. You know, one of the other things that we've learned is that the food insecurity is just tremendous in Afghanistan. There is food available. There's just not enough money for anybody to purchase it. So people are so demonstrably poor because of the collapse of the Afghan economy that there's an ongoing active famine. Just, we did our first survey back at the beginning of the year, and we asked questions about food insecurity. What was illuminating then was that 98% of respondents had reported a skipping of at least one meal in the last 10 days. That number increased to skipping more than not just in the last 10 days, but basically missing a third of all meals over each month now. So their food intake, what we fear, has been reduced by on average a third per person. And given the ongoing, you know, global food crisis because of the war in Ukraine, the food aid that normally would be reaching Afghanistan is not. And it's also not reaching it because the Taliban simply don't have very good relationships with the global community on this. And they have been quietly trying to circumvent the World Food Program and its distribution of food aid simply put, the Taliban have also run out of money. And so they pay their fighters in 10 kilogram bags of wheat flour. They get a 10 kilogram bag of wheat flour each week. The last thing which was really illuminating was, and this is the thing that we've quite frankly been arguing with the State Department since the evac on, which was how many Afghan special visa applicants truly still remain in Afghanistan. And the survey is quite clear. It's the vast majority of them. It's some 160,000 people at this point. Simply put, we did not evacuate the vast majority of the SIVs last August. They did not make it to the airport. They did not make it onto the planes.
So Shala, I was wondering, as the only lawyer here on this panel, if you could sort of help us go through some of those issues with, you know, differentiate SIVs from other forms of humanitarian parole for those in the United States or those eligible to apply.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Just a little bit about some of the work that Human Rights First does with respect to our coalition building. We have about 300 members of our coalition. These are different legal service providers, resettlement agencies, law firms, law schools, solo practitioners. Everyone who's come together really around the time that Colonel Miska has identified April and really for the purposes of our program starting September, August and September, when the very first evacuees were brought to the U.S. And everyone's come together to kind of answer one question, right? And that's what next? Exactly as was identified, the parole that Afghans were permitted to enter into the U.S. with, it's a two-year parole. It does not afford any permanent rights in the U.S., right? So in the 2 years that they're here, they have a work permit, social security card, and you know, the right to live in the U.S., frankly, and without fear of deportation. But what happens after those 2 years? And so it's really the legal community that's come together with, I have to say, all pro bono partners, right? No one really here is making a dime off of this population in particular. And everyone's trying to figure out what the best use of our resources is here. Absent an Afghan Adjustment Act, which I'm sure we'll touch upon a little bit later, which would be a law that would grant permanent residence to all Afghan evacuees here. Absent that law, we've got to now get creative and make sure that all the 85,000 Afghan nationals that are here apply for the legal remedies that they're eligible for and apply in a timely manner. So the two biggest applications that we're seeing among this population is the special immigrant visa and asylum. To put it really sort of broadly, the special immigrant visa was created in 2006 for Afghans in 2009. And it was meant for interpreters who served alongside US troops in Afghanistan, who'd served a certain period of time. Those conditions have been relaxed, thankfully, over a decade that it's been a reality. And now it requires one to have served 1 year of faithful service to a U.S. government entity in Afghanistan, and you have to have the requisite documents to prove your time there. So we've come upon a number of challenges, a lot of which the podcast covers really, really well, Bryce, with respect to the human resources letter, the supervisor letter, the fact that a lot of organizations and companies there disappeared without a trace. And so getting all those documents is really critical. And for those folks that were not able to and are not able to locate their supervisors, it's become a near impossibility to become eligible for SIV. Everyone else then would be eligible for asylum, and asylum law applies to all nationals of all countries in the U.S. And for that, you have to demonstrate a reasonable fear of persecution should you be returned back to your home country on a variety of bases. And among Afghan evacuees, we're seeing the most common reasons for applying for asylum is, in fact, political opinion. You've got ethnic and religious minorities that are evacuated here, folks that are members of particular social groups, in particular those that were Afghan military, Afghan pilots, Afghan police, judges, lawyers, members of the Afghan government, human rights activists, you name it. You've got, you know, all of civil society really that fled Afghanistan, those that, they're really the lucky ones, those that could, and they're here, and they've all, absent a larger law that would enable them to apply for a green card, have to individually apply for asylum. The asylum system is incredibly backlogged. We've got 600,000 cases just at the asylum office right now. And if you include those cases that are in the immigration courts, you've got 1.5 million. So again, you know, to think about, especially in light of the information just shared by Matt about how the overwhelming majority of SIVs are actually left behind, are we as a legal community utilizing her resources in the best way, right? Wouldn't it make sense for us to come together and work on those applications for those folks that are not yet in the US instead of doing all of this for those folks that are, but here we are still, we've got to work on those until the law's passed.
So one other thing, Shala, that I've heard you speak about is really the lack of international coordination. You just covered some of the more domestic legal issues, but I was wondering if you could speak to that, because a lot of people flee Afghanistan and then are left to try and apply from somewhere else like Pakistan. So I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So again, we're speaking about folks that have legal pathways to come to the US. So these would be SIV applicants, their derivatives, both those that are abroad and those that are here as we're processing the 85,000 applications for 85,000 folks that are here. We are thankfully getting approvals. Just to give folks an idea, there's a 99% asylum grant rate for Afghan evacuees currently, which again speaks to the fact that is this whole operation futile at this point if everyone basically is being granted asylum. But nonetheless, for those folks that have legal mechanisms to come to the US, by and large, the only way out of Afghanistan is through Pakistan, right? And that's really contingent on the Pakistani government issuing visas. Pakistani law requires all folks who exit the country legally to remain in lawful status the entire time. And what that means right now is reissuing 30-day visas. And not all folks who are requesting visas, by the way, are being granted visas. But those folks that are lucky enough, they're getting visas and they've got to renew them in 30 days. Ordinarily, UNHCR operates out of Pakistan to register Afghans. They've been doing so since the 80s. As we know, the country's been in pretty much constant conflict since the early 80s. But right now, that's also been at a standstill. So Afghans cannot register themselves with UNHCR. A benefit of that would have been, as long as you're registered with UNHCR, you're in legal status because you're in the process of applying for asylum protection under UNHCR. But that's no longer a reality, right? So visas are, number one, not guaranteed, number two, not renewed. Additionally, you've got a lot of Afghans that are being attacked on the street in Pakistan for a variety of reasons. Think about, again, the kinds of groups of folks that are fleeing. You've got LGBT persons that have perhaps abandoned Islam or espouse secular views, whether that be personal secular views or political secular views. And those folks that frankly have political opinions that are contrary to the status quo in Pakistan. So you've got a lot of individualized sort of risks to Afghans that are in Pakistan right now. And the processing time is just simply, I would say, unacceptable. You've got folks that have been waiting since literally the start of the evacuation with valid ways of processing to the US, of coming to the US, that still have no movement on their cases. It's really, I would say, the equivalent of, imagine North Korea and South Korea at war with each other, right? And then we ask the South Koreans to consular process in China. Right, it's that, right? It's how safe do you feel as an Afghan going to Pakistan to apply for a visa to come to the US when it's Pakistan that's overtly and covertly funding the Taliban and have done so for decades. Really what I think this really shows us is not only to make the US Embassy in Islamabad work better and work for our allies and for, right, the family members of US citizens and other folks who are vulnerable, but really to create a new system, right? To designate a consulate somewhere in the world that whose job would be to just process Afghans. And I would really propose here, we have some really strong and reliable allies in the Balkans, in particular Albania and Kosovo, right? Both of those states right now do processing for evacuees. There's talk about expanding some of those operations. You know, I think it would be a really win-win situation, not only for those countries to pay it forward, because we have a lot of goodwill in the Balkans as compared to a lot of places in the world. And we found that they've been quite eager to assist the US and the US allies there. And really a safe place where Afghans can go, complete their consular processing, do the interview, do the background checks, do the medical exams, do everything we all need to do to make sure that they enter the country lawfully with the right status, and they're able to reunite with their families here.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And Colonel Biska, how has that lack of international coordination affected the Evacuate Our Allies Coalition's work?
It's been challenging in a lot of ways. And I don't have a lot of specifics in this area, but what happened early on was there were a lot of well-meaning organizations that stepped up and helped get Afghans out into third countries. And then what happened was there was no follow-on destination. And so there really hasn't been a coordinated effort internationally to try to resolve just that issue alone, let alone the other things that Shala was just bringing up, right? And so it's a challenge, and especially when the world is distracted, as you know, they are very distracted by, we are distracted by Ukraine, and that has drawn the media attention, it has drawn the political attention of our European partners who were very much a part of NATO. And so what I would love to see, and we've got partners in Germany and France and some of the other European countries who have really advocated for protecting our soft networks, right? For helping those who serve alongside of us in conflict zones. But the systems are very uneven. The responses are uneven as well. And so you'll see certain countries, as Shala pointed out, that are very receptive and help within their capacity. And then other countries don't have that level of warmth. And so you end up with a really uneven playing field out there. But international cooperation could go a long way.
So I want to move to the Afghan Adjustment Act that Shala mentioned. And it would really touch on if that legislation were to pass, which we'll get into the status of in a second. But it would really touch on a lot of the issues that you have all been speaking about here today. So my first question, and Matt, I'm going to hand this to you, is, you know, what is the status of the Afghan Adjustment Act? And for Shala, what would it do? What would it do to affect all of this? And what's sort of what are some of the proposals that people are seeing? So I guess let me flip that around. Let's start with Shala. What would it do? And then we'll go to Matt with the status.
Sure, happy to answer that. So the Afghan Adjustment Act, as it's being proposed, would allow all Afghans who were evacuated here by the US government to be able to apply for a green card after being here for 1 year. So on the 1 year anniversary of their entry, they could apply directly for a green card. All applicants for a green card have to go through what they call biometrics. So they run fingerprints and make sure that you don't have any outstanding criminal records or, you know, just generally a law-abiding person in the US. Of course, they've already gone through background checks, right, in order to come here in the first place through the evacuation, really lengthy background checks. But really what it would do is it would cut out the middleman. It would cut out the need to apply for asylum, for them to show an individualized harm, an individualized threat. It would cut out the need to try to locate now supervisors for folks that were SIV eligible, try to locate these phantom companies that existed and maybe haven't existed for over a decade or so. And it would just allow folks to apply for a green card and really be sure of the fact that they can continue their lives or start their lives anew here in the US without any additional legal barriers. It would eliminate the need for, or the fear really, for being deported back to Afghanistan and potentially back in harm's way and back in the hands of the Taliban.
And Matt, what is the status of the Afghan Adjustment Act, and what had been the hopes a couple months ago for the Afghan Adjustment Act?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll start off with the hope had been that we were going to get it passed in what's called the Ukraine Supplemental. So the law that Congress passed about a month ago that funded our aid efforts to Ukraine. So this is a lot of inside political baseball here, but in an election year, Congress really doesn't get a whole lot done. A lot of people don't like being put on the record in an election year for votes because they feel that it might make voters mad at them. And it's not something I'm a big fan of, by the way, but that's just the way our system of government works. So there's a couple of must-pass bills however, that Congress has to pass every year. These are spending bills, right? The one's called the omnibus bill. It's the sort of the law that funds the government for a fiscal year. The other is the National Defense Authorization Act. It funds the military. There's the Senate Foreign Ops Bill, which funds the State Department. And in this case, Congress decided, because of the war in Ukraine, that they had to pass a must-pass bill to give the president authority to spend billions of dollars in Ukraine. So we tried to get the Afghan Adjustment Act attached to that. It failed because of Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Senator Grassley, for whatever reason, hates immigration, and he does not like this population of people. And he feels that the Biden administration illegally used humanitarian parole to bring the Afghans who were evacuated last August into the United States. He believes that the Biden administration did it as political top cover for its failures in Afghanistan. And I really don't care what his reasonings are for voting against it. I wish he would understand that by refusing to allow this bill to come up for a vote, and unfortunately in the Senate, an individual senator can do that. They can put what's called a hold on a bill and by and large prevent it from ever coming to a vote, which he has all but done. He's hurting American national security in the future. He's hurting our credibility. He's hurting our ability to recruit future allies. You know, we've already done just about as much damage as we can to our credibility around the world by abandoning these people in the first place. But the fact is that we're able to get some out. And the idea that we would now put them in jeopardy and potentially one day even deport them is important to me. And if it was to come to pass, I don't know how any ally in the future could ever look to us and trust us and take us at our word when we said that we're going to have their back if needed. So the current status is this: there is a bipartisan group of senators and House representatives, Republicans and Democrats on both sides, that want to vote on this thing. And if it came up for a fair vote, I think it would pass. The problem is that right now, Senator Grassley has his objections, and it seems to be until he can be mitigated and brought into the fold, there is a hesitancy to even bring it up and introduce it formally into Congress, because the last thing anyone wants us to have happen is that it gets introduced for a vote and then it goes nowhere and dies on a vine, right? People really only want this thing to be officially put on the record when it's going to be a must-pass bill. And so to that end, we've really been letting our counterparts, the staff and the members of the United States Senate who have been leading this, really lead on that process. And we've been following their guidance, which is why you don't have a bill number attached to this thing. Well, there's no legislative text, because the reality is that they're still trying to figure out what is going to be the acceptable text that everyone can agree to pass. And they don't want to introduce anything until they have that solidified. What I will tell you, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring this up. One other thing that the bill does do, and this for me is a massive important thing, and it was illuminated in the AWA report, and forgive me, I didn't mention it. There is a coming crisis in the SIV application program right now. Simply put, applicants are running into the provision that requires them to have an in-person interview at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul in order to be given an SIV. There is no more U.S. Embassy in Kabul, so these in-person interviews cannot take place. And so every applicant in the SIV program is eventually going to run into a problem where their application can advance no further. The AAA, the Afghan Adjustment Act, would grant the State Department the authority and the ability to conduct these interviews elsewhere, in other embassies around the world, potentially online, in some sort of secure Zoom. Or while we don't have an embassy in Taiwan, we have a U.S. interest section at somebody else's embassy. We would ostensibly, they could set up a U.S. interest office at the embassy of Qatar, for example, or the United Arab Emirates, which has formally recognized the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. All of this is to say is that my friend Sean Van Diver has a really good point that he likes to sort of browbeat members of Congress with, and I would be remiss if I didn't say it now, which is that, you know, a year ago, last August, it seemed to be just about everybody in this country really cared about Afghans and the lives of Afghans. And that makes sense. We've had for 20 years, successive presidents and administrations from both sides of the aisle tell us, the American people, that we should really care about Afghans in their lives. And you know what? The messaging worked. Americans really seem to care about Afghans in their lives, and they don't like what they're seeing right now. I wish then that the goodwill that was expressed last August would be allowed to carry over to the Afghan Adjustment Act, because I don't think anybody who was involved in the evac last summer was doing it with the belief that the people that they were helping get to safety might one day have that safety taken away from them and the rug pulled out from underneath them. And that's why the Afghan Adjustment Act is so critically important, because if we don't pass it, there is a future. There is a future nightmare scenario where a new administration comes to power that doesn't feel as the Biden administration and doesn't see these people as welcome in this country and moves to deport them.
All right, let's move to audience questions. Melissa from the Global Advocacy Group asks that she says she would appreciate hearing how dramatically different the humanitarian parole situation between Ukrainians and Afghans is. So Shala, let's start with you.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'll start out by explaining a little bit about what humanitarian parole is and the numbers specific to Afghans. So humanitarian parole has been around for quite a while. It's again open to nationality, persons of all different nationalities. And it's really used in emergency situations to allow an emergency really entrance permit into the US. It was actually encouraged following the events of August of last year, August 2021, with the collapse of the Afghan government and the takeover by the Taliban. It was encouraged by members of Congress and the administration as a pathway for US citizens to petition for their family members, friends, loved ones, right? American citizens that worked, for example, alongside Afghans in Afghanistan as a way to get them to safety. To date, about 45,000 humanitarian parole applications were filed for Afghans, and that was at $575 per application. And you needed an application for every single man, woman, and child that wanted to apply for humanitarian parole. And that's starting, of course, since about August of last year. Of those 45,000, only about 5% have been decided. And of those five, 85% have been denied. So we've got really appalling numbers. You know, the requirements by which one had to even satisfy to be eligible for humanitarian parole for an Afghan, again, were that you had to have shown individualized harm. So really a harm that is well beyond what's required in asylum. So it would be Matt Zeller is wanted by the Taliban, and his name had to have been published in a US government report, in the New York Times, Amnesty International, or a really reputable source as being, you know, a person of interest and would be persecuted by the Taliban, again, by name, right? That is not the requirements that even asylum requires. The person also needed to have left Afghanistan to begin with. So they were not processing any cases for Afghans that were still stuck in Afghanistan. And the reason given was, again, because they needed a consular process and there's no US embassy in Afghanistan at the moment. Compared to that, to the U for U program, or United for Ukrainians, for that program, the US government has promised 100,000 slots. I believe they've assigned about a third of those already, and that's just within about 2 months since the program's been rolled out. There's no fee for that application. No need to be outside of Ukraine. Everything can be done through a website on your telephone. You don't need to show any individualized harm, just that you've been displaced by the Russian conflict. No consular processing, no interview. Everything's, again, done online, and the travel documents emailed right to your phone. We're hearing reports of folks who have filed humanitarian parole under the U4U program and within 8 days have arrived in the U.S. So again, comparing to over, was it now 10 months? 10 months for Afghans, the vast majority have not even been decided. So it's really, I think, illustrated to us that we did need and we do need a better processing to bring large numbers of people to the U.S. Safely and very quickly. And we need to do the same for our Afghan allies, right? There's no reason why we can't learn from the U4U program and now implement that to the Afghans who, by the way, we've had a number of clients literally have died, have been killed waiting for the outcome of humanitarian parole. So to say that they're at harm's way is really an understatement here. I don't see there's any reason why we can't implement the U4U program directly to the Afghan population.
Kristen asks a question that is somewhat difficult to answer, but I think is important to as we go forward, which is how could we have moved more efficiently to get SIV holders out of the country faster without causing the Afghan government to collapse even faster? And this is a question that a lot of people on this panel have tried to answer. And maybe I'll ask more, I'll start with Matt, which is, you know, what were advocates saying a year ago in order to try to answer that question?
So in the alternate universe that I wish I lived in, where we were listened to, the following occurred. We wrote a report, we being Kim Stifuri, myself, and Chris Purdy of Vets for American Ideals, over the winter of 2020 into January of 2021, that we quietly delivered to the administration, in which we recommended that they begin the immediate evacuation of every single SIV applicant, regardless of where they were in the processing line, and that they begin moving them to Guam, where we could use Guam as a lily pad from which we could then figure out how we were going to resettle them in the United States. We based this on the evacuation of Saigon in 1975, which used Guam as a lily pad. We recommended that it begin immediately for the following reason. In January of 2021, we had 2,000 US military troops in Afghanistan, and we controlled every single airfield. We had the ability, because it was also not fighting season at that point, and the Afghan military wasn't actively engaged in a running gun battle in most places like with the Taliban, we had the ability to then quietly begin going out into the hinterland, into the villages where most of these people lived, bringing them back to these smaller bases. And we could have done this in a methodical, orderly way that, quite frankly, we're talking about a population of under 200,000 people here. You wouldn't have noticed it. If it had been done in secret and in quiet, we would have been able to move these people out without most of the Afghan people getting wise to it, without creating or inciting a panic. I'm convinced of it. But there wasn't political will in our White House to do that. And that's why it didn't take place. It wasn't that we didn't have the capabilities. It wasn't that, and trust me, and talking with the folks that I know in the US military, they wanted to do this. It was the lack of the political will at the highest levels of our government to get this done.
Colonel Miska, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would just offer that the entire, well, not the entire veteran community, but a large majority of the veteran community really rose up as we saw the train wreck coming and partnered with organizations like Human Rights First and humanitarians writ large, which, you know, we're not usual bedfellows in advocacy, right? And we were really strongly recommending to do something, right? And I didn't want to get around to saying exactly what it should be. I know our military, if tasked, can plan for contingencies and do that. But it really, the writing was on the wall when, as Matt noted, we pulled out the anchor species, right? But the anchor species in that ecosystem was really the US military, of which the contracting community was around it. The contracting community was traumatized by what happened. They were coming to our coalition asking, what can we do to get our Afghan employees out? And so it's something we've got to get better at in the future. We can, I know we can. There are policy options out there that we can pursue, and hopefully we'll have the political will to do that.
And our next question comes from Walter, who asks, did we do any better in the Vietnam departure? Which that's a complicated question. And I would recommend the book Honorable Exit by Thurston Clark to Walter if he wants to learn sort of more about how that went. But Colonel Miska, you've studied this issue. You mean, you've not only worked on it, but you've studied it academically. Maybe sort of help us, give us a sense of how we did in Vietnam. And you mentioned the Kurdish evacuation earlier.
Yeah. it's hard to make comparisons like this because there is always trauma, right? Every single Afghan case that has got here to the United States is still associated with trauma. They weren't able to bring their adult children. They weren't, you know, and so the same applies to Vietnam. But what I would say is that there were some major distinctions. 80% of the Vietnamese refugees went by sea. This was a point we kept making back in May, June, and July, that name the seaports in Afghanistan and I will, you know, go get my ticket, because it's going to be bad when we lose the airfields. And when that happened, it really precluded a lot of options that we could have exercised. And so it went from a comparison to Vietnam, at least to many people feeling it was worse, as we watched the zombie apocalypse outside the gate of Hamid Karzai International Airport, as we saw people cling to wheel wells. And so it was really, I would just say that for the veterans that I know who were involved in this, for me personally, it was harder in many ways than when I was in combat in Baghdad.
So our last audience question before some closing thoughts comes from Fritz, who asks, what can the U.S. learn from various allied nations about how they handled their partners, whether Afghans or other conflict zones who needed evacuation and resettlement? And before we jump into some answers, I will say that the University of York came out with a report last week or maybe 2 weeks ago that sought to answer this exact question and had a number of metrics that compared the U.S. to a bunch of different allied nations. So I direct you to that report, but maybe Shala or Matt, if you have any quick thoughts on that.
I think the Aussies do it best in terms of resettlement after the fact. Like if you can get into Australia and you're not sent to an immigration prison island that they run, and you're actually welcomed in Australian society, they do a really wonderful job with housing, employment, et cetera. You know, I think the big frustration I heard from folks who were over there amongst the American military was, again, the frustration that they had in watching other allied militaries be able to leave the airport and go out and physically move people through Kabul, beyond past Taliban checkpoints onto the airport and provide that level of security that they wanted to be able to do for their citizens. A lot of people don't realize the American military was forbidden from leaving the compound. They could not leave the airport during the evacuation. We were wholly dependent on other nations' militaries, either moving our own citizens or our Afghan allied partners who were still in uniform, still showing up for duty, meaning soldiers of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, who were still doing their jobs for us, helping to move people through Taliban lines and stuff to get them to the airport. By the way, those people were amongst the people that we evacuated who now are in desperate need of the Afghan Adjustment Act to pass. Let's be clear that in the evac, it wasn't just civilians. We got out members of the Afghan military who continued to function in their jobs all the way up until the very last moment. And the idea that we would one day turn our back on them is just important to me. But I think there's a lot of lessons learned. I agree. The report is fantastic. I highly recommend folks give it a read.
And Shala, do you have anything to add to that before our final closing thoughts?
Yeah, I would just add, you know, Canada has a private sponsorship program for immigrants. And I think that this is really a time to roll something like that out, right? Because of all the reasons that were highlighted by my co-panelists, there's a lot of goodwill and a lot of interest by everyday Americans to bring Afghans to safety. And I think a program like Canada's that would allow a certain number of Canadian citizens to come together and petition their local representatives for specific immigrants, I think would do wonders and literally save lives here.
All right, so for our final question, something that Max and I have found while we were making the show was that a lot of private citizens, such as yourselves, have really stepped up and tried to fill the void in a lot of senses that U.S. immigration bureaucracy and the government have really left wide open. So my question to all the panelists is, you know, if you're someone who's watched this, whether they're lawyer or civilian veteran, and they want to get involved in some way, do something about this, you know, what would you tell them to do? And I'll start with Colonel Miska, then we'll go to Shala, and then we'll close out with Matt.
So this is a great question, Bryce, because it's really, I think a lot of Americans struggle with how to thank their veterans. And because this resonated so strongly with the veteran community, if you want to really help us welcome our Afghan partners who served in conflict with us, who are fleeing violence. And you can do that in a lot of different ways. You can, if you know a veteran, reach out, see if they're in touch with anybody and assist along those lines. But the resettlement agencies have local affiliates throughout the country in many different areas. You can just Google, how can I help an Afghan refugee? Figure out where the resettlement agencies are in your neck of the woods and give them a call, because they all need help, whether it's through volunteering resources or if you're fortunate enough to be involved in some sort of sponsorship program.
And Shala, if there are any attorneys watching or law students or something like that, what would you tell them?
Sure. So Human Rights First would love to have more pro bonos involved in our legal efforts to not only do screenings for Afghan individuals who are in the U.S., but also assist with application preparation. That's applications for a green card. We now have TPS available, temporary protected status, and other forms of relief, not only for the individual who's here, but God willing, one day soon, so they can petition also for their family members who are still stuck abroad. And lastly, for direct representation with asylum applications. You can find this on the We the Action platform and look up Human Rights First and Welcome Legal Alliance and look out for opportunities there.
Great. And Matt, the final word.
I've been involved in this work since 2013. And what I've learned is that the fundamental difference between somebody really truly integrating and being properly resettled in this country or ending up in endemic poverty is the degree to which and the speed at which we can pair an Afghan with a veteran. That is as Steve has called it, the anchor species in this relationship is the veteran. There's just not a better advocate for an Afghan to help come into the American community and start their new lives here in a productive and fruitful way. I would also argue, we've touched on a little bit, veterans have suffered a tremendous moral injury with the end of the Afghan war and how it ended. The best way that I have found to address and heal from that moral injury is to assist in the resettlement of these people. It's in a way, if you served with them overseas, we're flipping the script where they were our cultural ambassadors and guides for us overseas. We now get to be that for them here. And there is just something that is deeply healing about that relationship. So to that end, I'm actively involved in a process right now with the Iraq and Afghan Veterans of America, IAVA. We're building out a national program where we're going to partner veterans with all the Afghans who have been resettled and try to just give them a person within the community who can be someone that would always answer questions. But more on point, the resettlement services that are provided to these Afghans only go so far and they're limited. And what we're trying to do is build relationships that will last a lifetime. So to that end, if you're a veteran who is interested in being involved with this, I encourage you you can email me. It's matt.zeller@iava.org. And we'd love to get you involved with this effort. Thanks.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much to our panelists.
Thanks for having us, Bryce.
A special thank you to the Brookings Institution for hosting that panel. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available to only our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Allies, The Aftermath, Rational Security, and Chatter. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. You can also buy Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.